Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam, we're going to talk with Associate Clinical Professor at Duke, Dr. Harold Cudler, about PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, huge topic, Christy, that we're reading about every day, about the increased stress and suicides and spousal abuse by people who return from these traumatic experiences in the military and elsewhere. So I'm really excited about that.
I am looking forward to it, too. But first, we have a lot of research that matters, particularly more related to kids and teenagers.
Yes. All you parents out there, take a listen, as well as for men. We got some interesting article that we're going to talk about in a second about testicular cancer.
The first one is about a program to help obese kids keep weight off long term. And as you know, Adam, there are so many different obesity programs aimed at youth, which are good programs, but there hasn't been good data or studies to show that they actually make a difference for people's lives.
Yeah, this is an article that was in the journal Pediatrics, Christy, and they took 200 children between the ages of 8 and 16 whose body mass index, that indicator of obesity, was in the highest 5% of their age and gender. So these were obese kids to look at two different interventions.
And for 6 months, the kids in the intervention group had aerobic exercise sessions twice a week. They had classes in nutrition and healthy behavior once a week. They also had, 6 months after that, they had sessions twice a month. They also had coaching for the parents on health and nutrition. So it was a very intense program that involved the whole family.
Yeah, and the other group, they got counseling, social worker, doctor, dietitian, every 6 months. So much less, but something. And then they followed these kids out for a year and getting the intervention, and then followed them for a year after that, after the intervention ended.
And in the first 6 months, the kids who got the intensive program had lost an average about 5 pounds. And over, as they follow them out, their body mass index, that indicator of their weight, continued to drop because they weren't losing weight, but they were growing at the same time.
And yeah, they gained weight, but not at the same rate, clearly, as the kids who had the less intensive intervention, whose body mass index actually went up, even though they were aging. So, you know, the bottom line is that there was some number of kids who were able to actually reduce their body mass index, but with a very intensive intervention for them and their families.
Yeah, I mean, it raises the question of is it practical? Is it, you know, it's not easy to get families to come together and participate in this.
Half the kids, Christy, dropped out of actually both groups. Even the one with minimal sort of intervention, half the kids dropped out of that one too.
Yeah, so that's a big tough thing, but I'm really excited that we have something that shows a benefit.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, most people probably couldn't afford this type of program, and unless insurance is covering it. So, but for parents out there, if you've got a child that's overweight and obese, this could work. And so we should bring it home and let's try it on.
Yep.
What's next?
Okay. The next one's about breastfeeding. So we have multiple studies showing benefits of breastfeeding. This particular study is looking at the link between breastfeeding and seizures in children.
Yeah, and this
or epilepsy.
Was in the Journal of Pediatrics. And, you know, these seizures, which typically happen at an early age but can happen at any age, to see what can we do to prevent them, because we don't really have a lot of data. And this was to see whether breastfeeding could decrease the chance of a child ever developing it. And so they looked at 70,000 children in Denmark.
And this is one of those things where the seizures aren't very common, but the estimate in this study was about 1 in 100 U.S. children and teens have 2 or more seizures during their childhood, but most outgrow the condition. But as they looked at this data, they found that babies who were breastfed more than 9 months had fewer seizures than those who didn't.
Yes. If they had just been breastfed for at least 3 months, that chance that you said of 1 in 100 went down to 1 in 135. If they were breastfed for 6 months, it went down to 1 in 150. If they had that full 9 months, it went down to 1 in 200.
Well, and in some ways it makes sense because we know that malnutrition or not having good nutrition during early developmental time can be is linked with seizures. And we know breast milk is perfect nutrition. So it's encouraging to know that there's another possible benefit. But I think, you know, it's another association and certainly needs more study.
Yeah, there's no downside to this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, we encourage it. This is another good reason. But it's kind of like quitting smoking. You know, one more reason to quit smoking. Here's one more reason to breastfeed.
Right.
So we encourage you to do it.
Okay. Now, this is a study about children with allergies or families who have allergies and the moms and dads are trying to do what they can to reduce their kids' risk for getting allergies through diet.
Yep. And, you know, a lot of us here, and I've got children who have allergies, and, you know, what can we do to lower their risk? And one of them maybe we've been taught or heard is that, you know, eat more fresh fruits and vegetables, which is always a great thing, but can that actually lower their risk of allergies? And there's been some data out there that suggests possibly, but this is a more detailed study.
Yeah. So this is a study of nearly 2,500 8-year-olds who had been a part of a larger study. About 7% of them had asthma. And initially, when they looked at the data, they found that the ones who had the biggest appetite for fruit had less than 2/3 the odds of getting hay fever and allergies than those who ate the least amount. But
unfortunately, a lot of these kids who had allergies, who were eating reduced fruits, had these pollens on the fruits that actually are things that are very similar. The proteins are very similar to the things they're allergic to. So if you exclude those kids from the analyses, it turns out that there's really not much of an association between this fruit and vegetable consumption and allergies.
So the take-home message for parents from my perspective on this is that fruits and vegetables are good. They probably don't prevent your child's risk of developing allergies, but they're good. And so we need more study to know more, and that's all we can draw from it.
And if you have a child, though, with allergies, don't necessarily promote fruits and vegetables increased over what you would in the hopes that it'll lessen their allergies, because probably is not going to work. You can look at this whole article in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, and we will post this journal on our online blog as well.
And the last one is about testicular cancer. So this sometimes happens in teenagers, if we're talking about a lot of kids today, Adam.
Well, it happens predominantly in men under the age of 30 and mm-hmm. only in men.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a serious and it's the most common cause of cancer in men under the age of 30. And it is something that we do see, though, in men over the age of 30 and even over the age of 40, but we don't talk about so much. So we just wanted to share with you one brief research article about this.
So this was a study looking at at the timing of when they were diagnosed with testicular cancer, and looked at 28,000 men and found that men who were diagnosed with testicular cancer at 40 years of age or older had 2 times the risk of dying from it than the younger patients.
Yeah, this study in the Journal of Clinical Oncology doesn't really say, you know, why the risk of dying is so much higher. And there could be lots of different reasons. Maybe a delay in diagnosis, the unwillingness to come in and get care as soon, people who have lower economic means, lots of reasons. But it also suggests that we shouldn't forget about that it happens to men over the age of 40 and that there's a much more serious risk of them dying, and we should be very cautious and careful about intervening as appropriately and quickly as we can.
So if you are a man and you notice any sort of a lump on your testicle or any changes there, go to your doctor, check it out. It usually doesn't hurt. But if you feel something there that wasn't there before, go check it out, because this is a curable cancer.
Yep. Under or over age of 40. Well, Christy, we've had a chance to talk about self-exams and testicular cancer, about if you've got allergies, fruit and veggies are good, but they're not going to lower your allergy risk.
About breastfeeding being linked to fewer seizures in children, and about programs to help obese kids lose weight and keep it off long term.
Well, hopefully that's some interesting research, and it concludes our research that matters.
It does. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Associate Clinical Professor at Duke, Dr. Cudler, about post-traumatic stress disorder. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health Radio with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Harold Cudler about post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, a really critically important issue to the American public.
And, I mean, when you think about how common this is, Adam, when I was looking at the statistics, I mean, about 60% of men, half of women experience some trauma in their life. And then about 7 or 8% of the whole population will have this post-traumatic stress disorder where they really have problems related to that trauma. So we are happy to have this important conversation today. Dr. Cudler is Associate Clinical Professor at Duke and founder of the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies, PTSD Practice Guidelines Task Force. Welcome, Dr. Cudler.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you both.
Well, it's great to have you here. When you first came here, we talked about this is just opening a door. It's the beginning of conversation. So we're just going to dive right in, for you and a lot of our guests is we want to understand how you got interested in your particular field that led you down this intricate path to want to deal with traumatic events that happen to so many of us, which is difficult to get into. In terms of how it resonates, it's not an easy topic.
No, it's really not. And especially because early on, people didn't know the statistics that Christy was just talking about. No one expected that 60% of Americans, if you were to ask them, had had a traumatic event at some point in their lifetime. I learned about it through my very first psychiatry rotation. That was 1980. I was beginning my training at the West Haven VA, which is part of the Yale program. And most of the veterans on the inpatient program that I was assigned were Vietnam veterans with a sprinkling of Korean War and World War II veterans. And what was interesting about those days is we had a lot of people in the hospital for a lot of reasons. It might have been that they were hearing voices or drinking or depressed. But very few doctors ever traced those problems back, even in the VA in those days, to having been at war.
Wow. Seems like that would have just been a natural connection.
Yeah, you would think so, but it really wasn't. And I was very lucky that my first supervisor was a fellow named Art Blank, who had been a psychiatrist in Vietnam. And Art was back supervising us and saying, well, did it occur to you to ask how these things might connect to their war experience? And he showed us some of the early books and articles about what came to be called PTSD. Back then it was called Vietnam Stress Syndrome. Mm. And I was fascinated. This was something new. They never taught us this in medical school. And you had to kind of whisper about it, even at the VA, because a lot of people weren't interested in that. They didn't look at the same patient that way. Well, I kind of caught a bug for it. And when I got my first job, it was here at the VA in Durham, North Carolina, and with Duke. And I've been there ever since and working on this and following this line.
So you've done a lot of work with people who've returned from war, with veterans. But when we're talking about trauma, we're talking about trauma from war, disaster, natural disasters, terrorism, even bullying in school or sexual abuse or child abuse. How do these things, these traumas that are so common in people's lives, how do they manifest themselves? What are the symptoms that people come in with this PTSD?
Well, that's one of the most interesting things about it, because while combat for men is the single most common cause of PTSD, for women, by the way, sexual trauma, there is this huge variety of things in which from disasters, you say, to bullying, car accidents. And yet there are common pathways, which is why we call this one disorder. There are three main groups of symptoms that go with having PTSD, all of which, by the way, have to follow an event that's so overwhelming that you really come to believe at that moment that either you're going to die or you're going to be very seriously injured, or someone you love is about to die or be injured, or maybe somebody you're standing there with is about to be. It has to be an overwhelming kind of trauma that you have to experience with a sense of fear, horror, dread, terror. Once that happens, the three symptom sets that you're most likely to have are starting with re-experiencing. The event comes back to you. It might be as a thought or an image, but it's not just a normal memory. Oh, I'm thinking about this now. It's like a thunderbolt. It's an idea that comes vividly to mind, often with the image, maybe with the sounds, the smells, and it can strike you so hard that for a moment, you don't really know if the events happening all over or if it's just a memory. This isn't like typical memories.
And this is like dreams that some people have or different?
It can start with conscious things and memories, often with a reminder. You were raped in an elevator. An elevator door opens and suddenly, bang, there you are. Mm. But it could happen in your dreams. Dreams of the event are one of the most common symptoms of PTSD. And then there's this idea of a flashback. And a flashback is something that happens while you're awake. But for that moment, you honestly don't know. Is it happening now? Am I in the past or am I in the present? Is this a memory or is this a perception right now?
How awful.
It can be really awful. And it can make you feel like you're losing your mind.
So even in that example you said, it could be not necessarily an elevator, but it could be an automatic door opening up to go inside a shopping center.
Or it could be the sound of your beeper going off in some way that's related, or your, or a cell phone of the person standing next to you.
So there's one group of symptoms that relates to this kind of reliving this traumatic experience. What else?
Well, there's the next group is avoidance. People go out of their way to avoid reminders. Sometimes this can be very manageable, the way a person with a phobia might avoid, say, dogs or open spaces, although that often takes some ingenuity after a point. But for some people, they can't go back to their place of work, say, if there was a workplace hostage taking. Or they can't go to an airport, say, if you were in combat and helicopters were there. Some people can't handle helicopters going over their home after they've been to war. Other people, it's more thematically related. A lot of war veterans I've known never went to their parents' funerals, not because they didn't love their parents, but the idea of death and that confrontation with death and with the people around them was more than they could take. An awful lot of people come back from war and no longer go to church, not because they've lost their religiosity or their need to be at church, but because being around a group of people, being within a group of people is just overwhelming. They really can't manage that. So avoidance is the next key group. And it can really lead to disabling problems, or it could be minor and something you can stand and you do it by gritting your teeth.
And what? And you mentioned there was a third one, or
the third one has to do with what we call physiologic hyperarousal. Big word. Bottom line is
not a good thing.
Not a good thing. Your heart races. You can't sleep. If you sleep, the least noise wakes you up. You're constantly scanning the environment. We call it hypervigilance. The bottom line is you're always on guard. You can't go to a restaurant because you can't track what's going on. Or if you go, you have what we call the gunfighter position. You sit with your back to the corner, you're facing the door, and you're watching everything that goes on. And if you can't do that, you cannot be in that public place.
Right. So it's like your instinct to protect yourself, that you're always sort of trying to be ready.
Yeah, you're on high alert. And people wonder, is this simply your biology is running amok, your heart rate is set too fast? And I'd say that was true, a startle being a big part of that. You know, why do people startle? But people with PTSD, especially combat PTSD, don't just hit the deck when a car backfires. They bring their wife down with them.
Well, I know we want to talk a lot about the military because of just the numbers alone that are happening around the country and the world with the U.S. And the fighting. But I just wonder if you could just say a little bit about sexual trauma. It reminded me of one of the most vivid cases a number of years ago of a woman that was referred to me who had been to an emergency room in Durham 3 or 4 times, and the parents calling me up because she kept going back to the emergency room, a college student, which after about spending 3 hours with her over about 2 to 3 days, it came back that she had been raped by her best friend growing up a month or two before. But this idea of this uncovery of the emergency room and these ill-defined symptoms, you know, the things that you describe, I don't know if I would have noticed any of those three things, but somehow tracking back through the fact multiple doctors hadn't quite gotten to what had happened to her, clearly something had triggered, and this appeared to be the precipitating event.
And that's a very common scenario. In fact, I learned in the emergency room years ago that when you couldn't figure out why a person was in the ER now, look back and see if there's any pattern to the dates they're presenting. And every once in a while, you may have noticed since your own practice, they'll show up in the emergency room like on April 15th, April 10th, April 12th, you know, going ten years running. But there's nobody else has noticed that pattern. You ask the question, listen, you keep coming around to April 10th. Is there anything happened around that time? And then you'll get that story, which they themselves were not quite thinking of, and yet they're pulled towards the emergency room. They need help, but they can't put into words what they need help with. And I'd say, you know, that might apply to that patient you're talking about. There's something they know they need help. They know you can get help from a doctor. I ought to go to the ER. But they haven't got the words for it. Frankly, one way I think about PTSD is it involves something you can't quite allow yourself to remember, but you can't quite forget either. And so you're stuck in that world where you're looking, groping for an answer. And you might well show up in the emergency room multiple times trying to articulate what's bothering you.
Fascinating. Well, we do need to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with our guest, Dr. Cudlor, about post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Associate Clinical Professor at Duke, Dr. Cudlor, about post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. And we've been talking about a really fascinating conversation about some really scary and fear-causing symptoms that patients have who have this syndrome. And in particular, you care for a lot of vets. We talked about that being a very common phenomenon among people who've been in war. Talk to us a little bit about that in North Carolina of our patients and families who've been to war.
Well, it's a very important issue here in North Carolina, where 1 out of 10 North Carolinians is a veteran. Plus, there are quite a few active duty people here, not to mention many, many Guard and Reserve members scattered in literally every community of the state.
750,000 veterans in North Carolina?
Yes, yeah, that's where we are.
Wow.
And they all have families. So this
affects a lot of people.
Exactly. And every practitioner in North Carolina, if they ask the patients they see, have you ever served in the military, they'll get that answer. The trouble is people don't ask that question very often.
Well, but everyone who serves in the military has PTSD, clearly. And I was having a conversation with an anesthesiologist over the weekend talking about did PTSD, was it as frequent in World War II as it is in Vietnam, as it is in the recent conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan? How is it different in the different cohorts and generations?
Well, the very best information comes from the Vietnam sample, and the reason is that we've had plenty of time to look at that. A lot of people didn't believe in PTSD back when those people came home, and a lot of people didn't know about it. It was really the veterans that told the doctors, we think there's a problem here, because people weren't looking for it. What they found when they did the National Vietnam Veteran Readjustment Study, it was published in 1990, is that 30% of anyone who actually served in Vietnam in the military developed PTSD at some point after coming back from the war, and that half of them who ever developed PTSD still had it by the time that study was done in the late 1980s, so 30%. When the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan got started and people began to come back, we were looking for this problem, and people had different estimates. Would it be 8%? People thought maybe 15% in some groups. And there was a very important early study from Charles Hogue at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in 2004 that said it's somewhere between 8 and 15% of people coming back from the war as of 2004.
Is that because of differences in how we're looking at it or how we're diagnosing it? Or do you think we're doing anything different in how we treat our soldiers or how we prepare them or what's happening? Are we doing anything that's maybe making it not as bad as we expected? I don't know.
Well, our
it sounds like it's a lot of people regardless. But.
Well, and you know, the fact is our preparations have helped a great deal. Plus, we teach people before they go to war. After they go to war, while they're in war, we're talking to them about it. If you have these issues, get help early. By the way, if you get help in country for problems that seem to suggest you might be developing these kinds of problems, 19 out of 20 will be returned to duty within 2 or 3 days and will do quite well. But the question is, what happens when they come home and now they're out of the war, the tempo changes, there's time to think and remember? Early on in the war, it was somewhere between 8 and 15%. But at this point, half of the people who ever served in Iraq and Afghanistan have used VA for at least one episode of care. And about over 20% of them, about 23% of them now, have been diagnosed with PTSD.
Wow.
So time is a factor. One of the critical differences is that Vietnam study was done 10, 15 years after most of those people came back. We're less than 10 years. We're about 10 years into these wars, and we're seeing of people who use VA about 20%. We don't know about the people who don't use VA, but half of them have used it.
Well, I know that in if you look at homelessness today, some estimates are that the overwhelming majority of people who are homeless are veterans. And I'm sure that the instance of PTSD has to be almost universal. If we're looking at today's returnees of from Iraq and Afghanistan, the thing that strikes me is the suicide rate in the Army and in the military that you hear about, essentially what appears to be almost epidemic rates. So regardless of the numbers, it appears that it translating into some very traumatic experiences for communities and lives. What do we know that we can do now to help improve this situation?
Well, the first thing is to realize that going to war creates a public health issue. And I don't want to say that, oh, we're ruining all these people. In fact, people who go to war, our military people are truly amazing, and their families are amazing. These are strong, resilient people that we have every right to be proud of. I don't for a minute want to say, oh, watch out for those veterans, because it's the exact opposite. These are people who are going to help take our state to the next place it needs to go. However, I used to believe that VA and DOD, if they did their jobs, would handle all this. Department of Defense and Department of Veterans Affairs would handle all this and everybody be ready and everybody get all the information and everybody have all the treatment. And I've come to see, even from the numbers I've told you, half the people eligible to use VA have already come to VA, but the other half have not. Where are they going? And where are their families going? They're going to community doctors who are probably not asking them, did you or someone you love serve in the military? And if so, what about this? What about that? Because if we know about these things, not everybody's going to get it, but if we know about them, we can get in there early before it leads to drinking, before it leads to depression, before the risk of suicide, which is related to both those things, and PTSD goes up.
Let's talk about treatment. What is really helpful and effective in patients who have PTSD?
So if we could increase our colleagues, and hopefully this show helps do that among colleagues, to start asking these types of questions, what do we do?
Well, I love to listen to this show, so I'm sure a lot of other colleagues are listening to this show.
Thank you.
There's a great deal that we can do. There are a number of effective treatments for PTSD, several very strong evidence-based psychotherapies. There are medications that help. I'm not saying any one of them by itself is a cure, but you can now have very effective treatment. And it begins with education of the military members and their families, but education of the providers. We've actually created a free online training program for community providers about PTSD. One is a general one. A second one is about traumatic brain injury. A third focuses on issues facing women veterans, who are about 12% of everybody serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. But people often don't ask women, by the way, are you a veteran?
I
read a statistic that 23 out of 100 women reported sexual assault when in the military.
Yes, well,
if that statistic's true, that's really profound.
And, you know, the average woman in the military has a higher chance of having been sexually assaulted before they join the military as well. And sexual assault of women up to age 21, 25, frankly, comes close to approaching that 20%.
Mm-hmm.
So that, unfortunately, this is a common problem. But being in the military, especially during deployment, women and men are subject to sexual harassment and sometimes sexual trauma. Not everyone who's harassed develops PTSD, but some will.
And what about that? You were mentioning this training program. Is there a website for any providers or even listeners that would like to actually see what state-of-the-art training is?
Well, I'll say it out loud and see if people can write it down.
And we'll put it on our website as well.
Okay, then I can say it faster. www.ahec, A-H-E-C, connect. Just one C there. ahecconnect.com/ citizen soldier.
Okay, so we'll definitely put
that
out there
as long.
And post that. And Other than the provider, one last thing about what do we do to maybe address this or even prevent it among even our the getting kids inoculated, the bullying that Christy talked about earlier? Is there some things that we're doing at the other end to prevent these things and give people tools and resources at an early age?
What the military has always done, realistic training is the best thing. But you can't really train somebody for war as war really is. You can fire automatic weapons at them on the practice range, but they know that nobody's really trying to kill them. So it's difficult. But I think a realistic appraisal and understanding realistically the problems you might have and having people not be afraid of this because it is treatable, but knowing about it and coming for treatment early before it does change their lives in ways that are hard to reclaim later.
And one last thing, I know that there's an event coming up for anti-bullying that may make an effect for prevention. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, we're going to be talking about bullying and at a program that features Dr. Richard Kogan on March 26th at Peace College. And you can get more information about this at www.ncpsychoanalysis.org.
And we'll post that again on our website. Well, we want to thank you, Dr. Cudlor. It's appropriate that you have opened a door. We're trying to walk in it. It's not a wide door, and we'll hopefully make it a little wider through your work and research. And thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health Radio with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to take some time to talk about your health questions and concerns.
Yeah, we've got some really important questions today about allergies and colds, about interactions and different drugs.
And about psoriasis, some really good questions. Let's take our first house call.
I'm very appreciative of the care that I get, particularly at the new cancer center, which is absolutely magnificent, having been through the old buildings, and particularly Dr. Voorhees and physician assistant John Strader, who see me once a month, and I have nothing but high praise for them, as well as the whole institution of cancer care.
Well, thank you. That's, Christy and I don't get too many comments that are just thanking not us. It'd be nice if you thanked us, but that's okay. Well, you're thanking the new cancer hospital at North Carolina, and that's a very nice comment.
And we do have just fantastic resources, fantastic physicians and nurses and staff at our cancer center, and are grateful that they are providing that care to you and glad that you're so pleased with it. Thank you for the comment.
You know, one of the things that I think is actually, and it raises a really important issue, which is, I think, one of the things that distinguishes a cancer hospital today, and what, in my book, makes it a top 10 hospital, is its service to people. Because I assume that you're going to get cutting-edge care at a comprehensive cancer center like Carolina or Duke or really any of these top cancer centers, but the commitment to making the experience, and I know that
the caring.
The caring part. And I know that's been a part of the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, but they really have really tried to work on. And I have some direct experience, unfortunately, with some patients who've been there recently, and they echo some of these comments that have been made there. So we appreciate bringing this issue up, and we want you to let us know if you have positive or even not so positive experiences, because we want to talk about them.
Let's take our next house call.
Hi, I have a question. It's coming up on the spring season, and I get confused sometimes about the different symptoms of allergies versus colds. If you could enlighten me on that sometime.
This is such a good question, and one I've struggled with myself lately. I didn't grow up with allergies, Adam, but just recently I have started developing some spring allergies where I get more sort of itchy eyes, runny nose.
You don't sound too nasal. Do you get nasal?
Just a little bit of a runny nose.
Don't get nasal on me, Christy.
I'll try.
Well,
but
initially, and those pollen is everywhere. I mean, you know, it's like I went to bed last night. Everything was fine. I woke up this morning. There's pollen on my porch. What happened?
Well, and even still, when your nose first starts running, it's hard to know. Am I starting to get a cold or is this allergy? So it's a great question.
And you could be sneezing. Right.
With
so
a cold
that
or
may
with
not
allergies.
Differentiate. The discharge could be clear in both. That doesn't differentiate it.
Yeah. Well, to me, when my eyes are really itchy, or when I have the itchy in the eye stuff, is when it tips me off that it's more of an allergic versus a cold. And also the length of time that you're having the symptoms. Most colds, you get better after several days or a week.
Yeah. And the symptoms can obviously coexist. You don't usually get a fever when you have just allergies. So, you know, hopefully if you have a fever, it's probably not allergies. Mm-hmm. What else? Anything else?
Not that comes to my mind. It's just,
you know,
difficult.
Yeah, I mean, if you get it every year, you'd be unfortunate to get a cold.
Yeah.
Every year around March 15th, you get a cold. That wouldn't work so well.
But if you're stumped by it and it's persisting, then go and talk to your doctor. Let them look in your nose and in the back of your throat and sort of ask you the typical allergy symptoms, and you may benefit from.
Yeah, don't suffer from a cold for 2 weeks.
I would agree with that. All right, let's take our next house call.
Doctor, my job requires me to stand on concrete all day long and my knees ache. What can I take for joint pain relief that won't interact with Dilantin?
That's a really difficult situation you're in. So first off, thank you for sharing that. Standing on your feet all day long is very difficult, particularly on concrete.
It is, and it's so important to be a working individual, and we, of course, want you to be able to continue to work. Figuring out how to take something for your pain that won't interact with Dilantin, which is a seizure medicine, is an important question because there are some medicines to avoid.
Yeah, and we'll answer some questions about the interactions. But one thing that you might want to talk with your doctor about, and we encourage our patients, Christy and I, to talk with us about, is can you make accommodations at work? People don't necessarily think that, but we can write doctor's notes mm-hmm. that would suggest that you would really benefit from 5 minutes, 15 minutes, an hour to get off your feet, maybe to get a stool near where you're having to stand to at least rest, and that could make a big improvement.
Also to have proper footwear, to make sure you're wearing really good shoes that support your arches and support your knees. So there are lots of other hidden questions in here.
Yeah, so what about this question of Dilantin? So we assume you're on that probably because of seizures, but regardless, the Dilantin has an effect on the liver, and so great question to worry about the interactions. The simple and short answer, and Christy can expand, is it's safe to take many things.
So the medicines that you might avoid are acetaminophen or Tylenol make it more difficult or actually easier for you to get higher levels of that Tylenol in your system. So
The Dilantin, but the Tylenol.
Right. When you're on Dilantin and you're taking a lot of acetaminophen or Tylenol, that could be potentially dangerous. So I would avoid that one.
But you could take a little, but just not a lot.
Right.
Not like three times a day.
And there's another anti-inflammatory medicine called Toradol that we sometimes give patients. I sometimes will give it in the office as a shot to help.
Right. And that can interact with the Dilantin and cause your Dilantin level to change, so you wouldn't really want to take that one.
But the good news is medicines like ibuprofen and Motrin, many of the stronger pain medicines like codeine.
Mm-hmm. Or just the pure narcotic without the acetaminophen in it, most of those are probably okay, particularly in the short-term basis.
Right. I wouldn't recommend those harder core medicines long-term, but short-term, they won't interact with the Dilantin anyway.
Well, hopefully that's helpful for you, and maybe we can find a little reference about interaction with Dilantin and drugs interact and put that on our website. So thanks so much for that question.
Let's do our last house call.
What are the treatment options for psoriasis other than traditional pharmaceuticals, which usually means steroids for those of us who would rather have alternative therapies or, like myself, who have had negative reactions to steroids in the past?
Treatment options for psoriasis. Oh, boy. I love this question.
I know.
You know,
I'm
love
like,
thin things.
Adam's going to be all over this.
Let me tell you what we can do. No. Well, we're not going to go into the entire universe because you asked us other than traditional pharmaceuticals, and you really talked about steroids. So there are other traditional pharmaceuticals.
Well, I'll just say that the most natural thing you can do that will help psoriasis, although not who may have other problems with it, is get sun. So being in the sun and exposing your skin to sun can be helpful in psoriasis. Of course, we don't want to encourage you to be out in the sun a whole lot because that can raise your risk of skin cancer.
Yeah, and usually in the direct sun, we would say no more than 30 minutes and sometimes even 15 minutes. And actually, here's a little tip, which is that there's some research, it's not the best, but it's not bad, that a saltwater bath in combination with this UV light or the sunlight actually can do better than just the sunlight alone. So maybe a saltwater bath to help get rid of those scales. And it does have to be apparently the saltwater that helps to remove some of those scales.
And there are other things. There are tar shampoos and creams and ointments and foam and all kinds of things you can talk with your doctor about.
That are over the counter. Mm-hmm. That's the old-fashioned treatment. Kind of smelly, kind of can stain your clothes, but boy, it's pretty effective.
And if you've got it in your scalp, that's a very common thing. It's over-the-counter tar shampoos.
And let's not forget the number one treatment that everyone needs to always remember when they have psoriasis, which is emollients, lotions, creams, things that can help cut down on inflammation in addition to get rid of those scales. So a lot of people don't think about it, but emollients twice a day in addition to all the other things we discussed.
Thank you for your questions. We've had a chance to talk a little bit about psoriasis.
And also about things that interact with drugs and allergies versus colds.
And about the new cancer center and fantastic care that one of our listeners has received there.
So thanks so much for sharing your experiences with us. And we hope that if you have your own experiences, you'll send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Or where else can they call?
Well, you can call us at 919-966-8081 or go to our blog. You can go to yourhealthradio.org, listen to old shows. It's really growing. Go check it out.
Yep. Even go to Twitter right now and send us a note about today's show or about your own question. And we'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Harold Cudler.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll see you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.